Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and today I'm pleased to have back on the show Eva Hare, who is a good friend of mine and the author of a great book, Consciousness, Bridging the Gap Between Conventional Science and the New Superscience of Quantum Mechanics. Eva is the host of the Infinite Consciousness radio show on BBS Radio, and she actually was the person who got me back onto BBS Radio with my show, Temple of Health. And today we're going to be talking about her book and the fascinating information in it about the nature of consciousness, the nature of mind, and how we can define these things and perhaps understand the world we live in. Thanks, Eva, for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Susan. It's always a pleasure to be on your show. Always.
So, would you like to tell our listening audience about how this book came into being? I know that it had a lot to do with what you were doing on your radio show.
Well, you probably better than myself, or equally to myself, know exactly how this book came to be. You were sitting around my kitchen table all those years when it was coming to fruition.
Right.
Remember all those conversations we used to have with the physicist Roy Scruggs?
Yep,
that's
we
kind of
did.
How it came. I guess when I had a dark night of the soul years ago, and I had this spiritual epiphany thing, and after it happened, I kind of woke up to a lot of information that literally overnight that I didn't know existed before. And so about how the world is really one big energy and not segregated human beings, really lots of little people running around like ants, but really just one big holographic thing of energy. And so I started wanting to know, why did that thing happen? How did I go to bed one night and wake up the next morning and know this stuff? You know, was it really real? Was I dreaming it? Was it just some figment of my imagination? So I started doing this radio show through just a synchronistic sequence of events. And then I started interviewing scientists, and I started asking them these questions that had prompted me when I woke up. You know, what happened? What made this happen to me? And what did it? You know, what were the... Was there any scientific cause for what happened to me? And did anybody else have these experiences? And so it kind of started off when I met Roy Scruggs and you, and we would sit around my dining room table for, you know, hours and weeks and years on end, talking about these big questions. What is consciousness? What is mind? Does the brain think? How does the brain, filter and interpret mind? You know, what is the difference between the mind and the universe and the little mind that chatters in our head? And so that's kind of how it all started. We came up with what I call the list of 20 questions, and I asked all of these scientists. I did probably 100 interviews, I imagine, something like that, over the years, because I started doing it in 2005, and the book came out in 2012. So, you know, many, many interviews, and I filtered them all down to, I think, 12, and that each interview, I just simply really transcribed it for my radio show, but I planned the questions before I interviewed them, and then I transcribed them and put my favorites in this book. That's how it kind of came to be.
So let's talk about how you came to choose the 12. Was it that they had kind of a theme amongst the 12 that you could put together and make some sense of the questions?
You know, that's a good question. You're the only person out of all these years I've been interviewing that's ever asked me that question. It's a really good question.
It's a practical question because I knew you had to do it. I knew you had a bunch of interviews.
Yeah. Thank you for asking, because I want people to know why I picked those 12. Out of all the people that I interviewed, I tried to pick the most respected and the most knowledgeable and reputable scientist in the world, who I tried to get. So I interviewed, you know, all of those people, and I tried to get with the ones that really stuck with the science, the reproducible science. I mean, everybody's got an opinion. You know, they said, okay, this is my background. I'm a physicist, and I do this, and this is what I think. But inevitably, there would be a place where the physicist would talk science, then he would stop and turn the page and talk religion. So it was almost like the synapse, you know, of nerve endings in your brain, except there was no synaptic gate, or there was, but there was no impulse jumping over the gate. They just stopped at one and started on another one. So I tried to get the ones who could tie the two in together. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Especially after reading the book and how they answered the questions.
So that's kind of... Go ahead.
Well, I just want to ask if you would maybe not go through all 12, but go through some of them to indicate to the audience who you actually chose and how they differ in terms of different... fields of science and expertise, because I think that's important.
Let me just open up the page here so I can go down the list in the order in which I got them. I think it's kind of interesting, too, the people that I got to write the foreword and the preface. But Joyce Kovelman is her name, and she's got three PhDs, actually, one in anatomy, one in psychology, and one in consciousness from Ken Wilber's Institute. And so it was really interesting to have the perspective of that woman who has, you know, knowledge in all of those fields, those integrated fields, to be able to read this book and read all the things that all the scientists had to say and go, yeah, you know, that's right. Because, if you know, she's certainly in a position. And then Stanislav Ojek, he's got several degrees himself, several PhDs as well, one in he's got a degree in engineering architecture, and another one in psychology, and I forget the other one, but he's got several himself. So it was interesting to get, and he happens to be the guy who years ago worked with Bill Tiller, because he had a camera, and every time he would take a picture, any camera, it doesn't matter which camera, but he liked to do photographs, he would take a picture. You could always see things in the picture that weren't there with the physical eye. And it happened throughout his energetically. You know, he could see spirit. They would snap in his photographs. So he had an open mind, thank God, but he also had to educate the hard science, you know, background as well as the mind background. So that was kind of interesting to have him. Now let me get on over here. So the first person that I interviewed, well, that I put in the book, was Bob John and Brenda Dunn. And Bob is the dean of the engineering department, or the dean emeritus, at Princeton University. And so if there's anybody that's pure more rocket scientist than Bob John, I fail to know who it is. You know, he's got a pretty rigorous background. And the next person was Christian De Quincey. And Christian is a philosopher, and he is a professor at the John F. Kennedy University and teaches philosophy. That's what he does. So he was able to view it from a philosophical perspective as well as a science perspective. The next person I interviewed was Dean Radin, who's the chief scientist at Noetic Sciences, and he has a background in engineering. I think he has I don't know if he has a PhD there, but I know he has a degree in engineering. He also has a degree in psychology. The next person I interviewed was a physicist at the University of Oregon, Amit Goswami. The next person was William Tiller, who was the chairman emeritus of the physics department at Stanford. The next person is Henry Stapp, and Henry is the director of the Lawrence Berkeley Physics Lab out in California. The next person was Irvin Laszlo, and Irvin, as you well know, is known as the father of systems theory, and he's been nominated for two Nobel Peace Prizes. He lives in Italy. Then Roland McCready, who's the director of the HeartMath Research Institute, and I think his background is, I'm not sure you know, is it engineering? I think so. Then Elizabeth Rauscher, who's probably the single most credentialed female physicist in the world. And last but certainly not least was Tom Campbell. I thought there was 12, but there's 11. And Tom is a nuclear physicist who's, you know, written the books My Big Toe, My Big Theory of Everything, and he works for NASA in Alabama. So that's kind of who I boiled them all down to, was those highly credentialed, respected individuals who had a varied and diverse but yet cohesive and similar perspectives.
Okay, well, let's go now to some of the common questions that were asked during these 11 interviews.
Well, I tried to ask them all the same questions, but of course the questions would vary just a little bit, you know, based on what their answers were.
Mm-hmm.
But they would start out, what is your definition of consciousness? And what I learned from this was a very profound thing. You know, when people talk about consciousness, you hear it all the time, all over the place. There's a huge market and a huge, what's the word, Susan? A lot of people chattering about it out in the world today. And so you kind of assume that they're all talking about the same thing. But when I ask these scientists, what is your definition of consciousness? One would say the zero-point field. One would say, oh, it's awareness. One would say it's the opposite of being in a coma. One would say it's aware that you're aware. One person would say it would be cognate, sensate. I forget all of them. Cognizant and sensate awareness, mental awareness. Another person would say it's the irreducible unit of an atom. Another person would say that it's the everything that is, or it's the quantum entanglement. So opposite of being in a coma. So I realized that we were not having a meeting of the mind, well, that these scientists were not having a meeting of the minds about what they were talking about. So when I would talk to them, out of all the scientists that I interviewed, a lot of them didn't like one another, or they respected one another, but they didn't necessarily like one another or even want to talk to the other one because they had such a difference of opinions about what that word that they were talking about. And really, it was all in the definition of that word, and they just didn't know it. When I sent Amit goes, sorry?
Oh, no, go ahead.
When I sent Amit Goswami his chapter to I sent everybody all the chapters because that's what I'm trying to do is bridge them. Amit called me and said, oh my God, Eva, I had no idea that this was going on in the world. No wonder that we can't have a leap in quantum mechanics because we don't even have, we're not all talking about the same thing, and we don't know that we're not talking about the same thing. So that was kind of my goal, to bridge that gap and get the physicists in the world talking. Sorry.
That's very important. The thing that jumped out at me was that there's two ways of looking at almost every question you're asking. One is from the little mind, and the other is from the big mind. The little mind being the mind that we all have, you know, our own personal mind. And then the big mind is like the connected mind where, you know, intuition, clairvoyance, creativity may come from, is us, our little mind linking into the big mind. So when you ask about consciousness, some of the scientists were very literal and were just in the little mind, which is if you're conscious, you're awake, and if you're in a coma, you're not conscious. You know, that would be the, you know, the one way of looking at it. And then Amit Goswami, of course, who says that consciousness is the ground of all being, he's looking at the big mind. You know, he's looking at the, you know, the overall consciousness, where he says that everything that is contained in this consciousness, the ground of all being. So that is what jumped out at me when they were, you know, there's different levels that you can interpret that question on.
It's a very important thing to understand, too, and it also tells us a great deal about ourselves, you know, because randomly when people talk about this topic, they don't realize there that there's that dual perspective. So I don't know, how many times have you ever had tried to talk to somebody about consciousness and you get into an argument about what it is that you're talking about?
I think it's because not that many people have had experiences whereby they leave their little mind and go into the bigger mind. Experiences like that would be near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, experiences when you're connected to things that are not within perceptual reality, but more extended reality, like reliving something in a past life. You're going outside of time space, that you're currently in, and experiencing something in the time space continuum that you're not currently in. So, I don't know how many people, but probably less than 10% of the population really understands these experiences or has these experiences that you had during the dark night of your soul when you woke up connected to everything. They're not going to be able to understand something that's not within their perceptual reality. And these experiences of expanded consciousness aren't within their expanded reality. That's what I think is going on.
You're absolutely right. You know, we always have to revert back to David Hawkins' work when we talk about those things and those gradients and consciousness. You know, how
you want to explain that to people, because I think that's a good point.
Well, that was another question that I asked all of them. Do you believe that there are gradients in conscious awareness? Because consciousness, I think we agreed upon when I would question further, even though you may not have a word for it, or they all may not use the same word, is everything that is, the irreducible unit of an atom where there's nothing left but energy. You know, there's no matter on the quantum level. So there's that. Mm-hmm. And then there's that part that how aware or how well do you know who you are? You know, the I am. When you say I am, who are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And how well do you know that identity? So in David Hawkins' book, Power Versus Force, not to be confused with Stephen Hawkins, he talks about how he has found 11 gradients of conscious awareness, and that each gradient is clearly identifiable. You know, they start out being very, very fear-based or very, very unaware of who the I am is within the person when you are saying I am, very unaware of who that person is, just fear-based. And then as the soul or the person grows, and he believes this to be over many, many lifetimes, not in this life, that in this life you only grow a very small amount.
Mm-hmm.
And up to the point of where you're fully enlightened, so to speak, as much as possible while you're still in a physical form, and being able to understand that you're one with everything, and that you're no better or no less better than any other person or living thing walking around. And then there's all those gradients in between where there's identifiable steps. You know, you start out fear-based, and then you start believing, you realize that, you know, something's not right with the way that I look at the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't believe that, you know, you've been following like a fundamental religion all your life, and then suddenly you don't believe that there's a burning hell, for example, or whatever
right.
it is that you believe. And then one day you go, you know what, I know that can't be right. Something is more, but you don't know what it is. So you go out on an adventure, and you start seeking and reading every mm-hmm. self-help book that you can find and talking to every single person that you can find that'll talk to you about this.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, you go to this place, this aha moment where, so that's what they're talking about, and you get it. And so then you want to go out and teach the world everything you know because you have the answer. But then
right.
after you have the answer, suddenly you realize, uh-oh, the more that I find out about this thing that I'm so interested in, the more I realize that I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So you go back into this mode of seeking and reading, but less reading and more introspective,
mm-hmm.
you know, meditation, looking into who you are. Then you come out from there, and you were willing to teach the people that want to listen, but you're not willing to go out to try to change the world, because suddenly you realize that you can't change anybody. You know, you can be the change that you want to see in the world, but you can't change anybody. And so you kind of maintain that position for a while. And then after that, you kind of go back into a state of another state of reclusivity where, you know what, I need to not have the stimulation of the horns honking and fighting for a parking place and the groveling and the anger and, you know, and you go back to that solitude space again. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's all those levels of different ways that we are, and it's not bad or good to be at one of those levels. It's no different from being 5 or 50.
Yeah.
I hope that makes sense, too.
I read in one of the books I reviewed the idea that the Earth has a huge variation in consciousness in its human inhabitants, anywhere from cannibals, and they describe the life of a cannibal. There's evidently currently cannibals in, I think, New Guinea or some place like that on the planet, or at least there was when I read the book. And the cannibals, they're different tribes that eat each other, and they're totally fear-based. They're afraid even to go out and like at night to wander out beyond the village, you know, even just to go to the bathroom or to go get something, because they're afraid they're going to be captured and eaten by the other tribe. Of course, both tribes are doing this. And so that kind of consciousness where you're afraid to even, you know, be a little bit outside your village, because you might get eaten, is currently on the planet at the same time that we have realized masters who can manifest gold coins in their hand or, you know, anything. I mean, Sai Baba was manifesting all sorts of stuff. These people are both alive at the same time on the planet, and evidently that's quite a range of consciousness to be on the planet at the same time. So I thought that was interesting.
That's very interesting. You know, I have another comment about that too. I think the same gradients, exist in animals. And here's why I think that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I moved up to the country and lived on a farm for the past couple of years, and I had chickens.
Mm-hmm.
And I had fish, and I had rabbits, and I had chickens, and I had my dogs. I had 4 different animals. I had bears that came on my property and snakes.
Mm-hmm.
So the chickens, when I would go out and see them, I mean, they would run like dinosaurs, you know. They were like real stupid and would run into each other and run over things and run over each other. But they were also tribal. So I know
mm-hmm.
that they had some kind of, I don't know if they had sense of self, but they certainly had sense of one another.
Mm-hmm.
And you could get them to not love you, but find some safety in you. Because over a period of time, I'd go out there and I'd say, Mommy's chickens, and then all come running to the gate.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was this horny toad, that sat out on my pond. And I'd go out, and he would croak, and I'd go out there at night and try to find him. And when I'd find him, I'd go to see him, and he would inevitably hop away. There was absolutely no communication with the horny toad,
mm-hmm.
none at all. Then I had a hummingbird that sat on my front porch, come to the feeder on my front porch. And we would literally get face-to-face, and he would, you know, be there suspended in air in front of my face, yet we had no communication. You know, I couldn't touch
mm-hmm.
him, and he didn't want to touch me, but we were, you know, 6 inches from one another. And then, of course, there's my dog that sits in my lap,
mm-hmm.
so, and who loves me back. So it made me think that there has to be gradients of consciousness in the animal kingdoms too. And the snake, you know, there were two different kinds of snakes, so it made me wonder. I had copperheads on my property. They wanted, you know, they didn't want anything to do with me, except perhaps, you know, if I got too close to bite me, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But then I had a black snake that lived at my house, and I would see him repeatedly. And he would come out, and I would get down on my knees. He was like 6 feet long, and I'd get down on my knees and look at him and talk to him. And he would raise up, and the two of us would look each other and talk, and I could pet him.
Mm-hmm.
But, it wasn't like a nurturing pet like my dog.
Right.
But it still let me know that there was some kind of conscious awareness there.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I just believe that it's in animals, too.
Oh, I think it is. So, you know, the level of conscious awareness that a person, the human has, will then either allow or not allow the ideas of consciousness, when you say the word consciousness, to even be within their ability to define or even appreciate what they are. So someone who has never had any experiences outside of their own limited personal reality would not understand Amit Goswami's definition of consciousness as the ground of all being, because they had no experience of that.
So what I think should be considered in the world, and I actually talked to somebody, I think his name is Matthew Bronson, years ago. He's a linguist out at Berkeley. I think that there's someone should, and you always say somebody else should do this, but I'm not qualified to do it myself. But somebody should come up with words, or maybe consciousness definition A, consciousness definition B, C, D. And when you talk, you use that definition so that everybody knows they're on the same page. Because if everybody suddenly got on the same page and understood what was being talked about, the fact that if a physicist could all come to the understanding there's no matter on the quantum level, they all understand that. But if they could talk about it and understand that if there's no matter on the quantum level, what does that leave? Nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So if we were to all understand that simultaneously, even for 30 seconds, if everybody in the world got it for 30 seconds, what would happen? We would have instantaneous peace throughout the world. Because
but
everybody would realize.
But doesn't it, David Hawkins, his theory is that you have to be vibrating at a certain rate in order to have these experiences. Don't you think?
Absolutely.
I mean, isn't it? Because, you know, when you're vibrating at, well, you know, he has a scale of, what, 0 to 1,000? If you're vibrating, he says the average person on Earth is, what, 200 and something, 230 or something?
Well,
do you remember
from
his book?
I think it's about like that, 230, I think so. Maybe up a little bit, I don't know. But I think the
it's under 300, though.
Yes. The key, I believe, is science is the basis for everything. We teach our kids science starting in kindergarten, preschool, you know, before you even go to kindergarten. We teach them that two apples and two apples is four apples, but that two apples and two oranges do not equal four apples or four oranges. You know, we teach them that. So if all of the physicists or all of the, you know, the top leaders in science, whoever they are, could all get on the same page, then this could, and get beyond the egos and just teach the flat science, there's no matter on the quantum level, then we could start teaching it in elementary school. So even though the person may not vibrate there, we're teaching them that fundamentally. So, your environment, we're changing the environment. What happens when you change the environment of a cell? You know, the whole
it
cell
changes. Right, yeah.
So we
I think that would be worthwhile. But, you know, the problem is that the scientists are not all on the same page with because so many of them live in the world that is totally third dimensional and nothing else. You know, they don't even, except for some of the superstring and quantum theorists, many, many scientists do not acknowledge anything outside the third dimension. And without acknowledging multidimensional reality, I don't know that you can teach the, you know, the things that you want to teach. And many, many scientists are incredibly egocentric.
Well, that's why I say that we should teach only the science and leave the egos, you know, in somewhere else. And because that's actually a big problem, and I'm not going to say any names and who it was that I talked to who did what I'm about to tell you, but a lot of there are lots of things that goes on, but one of the things, not all of the things, but one of the things, many scientists tend to be egocentric and reclusive. They stay in their little laboratories trying to do their thing, and they're not making themselves aware of what else is going on in the world because they're so busy trying to get that grant or prove that theory or do whatever it is that they have to do. Mm-hmm. So when I was going through this interview process, and I would interview them, I'd say, hey, did you know that so-and-so is doing the same kind of research that you're doing, but it's a little bit different? No. Well, do you know who they are? Never heard of them. And these, I tried to pick the best scientists in the world, and they've never heard of each other.
Yeah,
one of them will have heard of the other one, and so I would try to introduce them, and guess what?
No, not interested. Yeah. Yeah. Well, reclusive people don't want to become non-reclusive. That's by definition.
But if you guys held hands, we could have a quantum leap in the world in this particular area of work that you're doing. No. I don't want to. And I'd go, but why? I mean, this would be great for science. No, I don't want to. They're afraid they'll steal their ideas and not get the prize, is what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't believe
that's
someone
true.
Else gets it. You know, and Rupert Sheldrake, you know, how he talks about the metamorphosis and, like, when one pigeon picked out the cap in the milk jug, all the other pigeons learned how to do it all over the world. Well, that's the same
right.
as science, but the scientists don't get that.
Right.
They don't get
they don't.
That somebody else can be doing the work, too. And if they would just hold hands, we'd have a better place and more advanced science.
Yeah, I agree. I think that that would be good. But only the scientists who are also evolved in their own consciousness are willing to do that.
That's exactly. Well, I won't say that because some of the people... Well, in reality, that's true from the perspective of where you and I look.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality from the scientist thinks he's already so evolved.
Right.
In fact, and we'll be writing on this spiritual evolution. We'll be writing it. That's one of Hawkins' gradients, as a matter of fact. You can write about it.
Mm-hmm. But not be
but
there.
You can't live it.
Right.
I mean, you can, but just because you write about it doesn't mean that you're living it. Those are two different things.
That's true.
Like talking about a good diet and then, you know, going everywhere.
Eating a good diet, right.
Talking the tight diet, but eating at McDonald's, you know.
Right, yeah.
It's kind of like
well,
that.
It's true, they because your consciousness is your individual consciousness is a result of every single response you have to external stimuli. And so if you go through life and everything is perceived as a threat rather than a non-threat, that your level of vibration will be very low. And then therefore, you'll be stuck at the lower end of the spectrum. Whereas if you see every perceived threat that might be a threat to most people, and you gather more information about it in meditation and through the ways that you and I gather information, and you find out that it's not a threat at all, but a message in order for you to change something, maybe even up ahead, and you do so, and then therefore you're not fear-based, you're actually more love-based, and then your vibration raises. So it is...
Yes.
That's exactly how your individual vibrational rate changes is how you interpret things coming in. You know, you know, have you ever met people who are, everything is a reason to be fearful? Like, they spend many of their thoughts and many of their actions are in response to, say, a fear of getting cancer or a fear of having the IRS, everything is interpreted. The IRS is going to audit me. I mean, I really have met people like this, business people, that, you know, everything they do is because they're afraid the IRS is going to audit them. Or patients, everything is going to cause cancer. Well, you and I know that because you're vibrating in that energy so much, you probably are attracting that to you rather than taking steps to make it not happen. You know, it's like you, the more you concentrate on something, even to make it not happen, the more you're likely to attract it into your life. So, you know, these are principles that we learn. So essentially, what we respond to with everything that happens in life, you know, whether or not you interpret, say a friend does something and you interpret it one way where it may or may not have been that way, but if you always interpret negative, then you're lowering your vibration. Every time you go into the negative with interpretation or with your thought, you're lowering your vibration. And every time you go the other way, you're raising your vibration. And I think what David was saying is that your vibrational rate at any minute is very important as to what you're going to be attracting into your life.
That's exactly right. And I just had that same conversation with someone this morning. You know, if you have two magnets, well, you know what they say, like attracts like, and there's such a thing as attractor fields.
Mm-hmm.
So, and even though you can't see it, we are electromagnetic beings. And when I believe, just like what you said, that when you think thoughts, whether they're positive or negative, you activate those attractor fields, which are real things in physics. So you can't help but draw those things to you energetically,
mm-hmm.
that you're thinking or behaving like. And I had something really interesting happen this morning, ironically. I was laying in the bed, and I was thinking about how can I see my life better? Because, you know, you can see your life, what's going on right here in this room or right here on this piece of property. But how do you get to see your big picture?
Mm-hmm.
And so I was thinking about that. And so I started thinking about the thing that made me think about, we had put a new monitor on my desk, and it kind of, the base on it made it stick out forward on my desk about an inch. Just that moving it forward that inch made me not be able to see what was on the screen. I mean, obviously I can see the screen, but I couldn't define the letters of the words and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense so far?
Mm-hmm.
So I got to thinking about that, and I started looking at, I kind of got out of my body and looked at my life, right, with my family. Then I
mm-hmm.
kind of imagined if I went up in the sky a little bit, you know, kind of came away from my body and going away from it and went up, and I could look down. Let's say I was on top of a building. Then I could look down. But I had a telescope. Then I could zoom in and see my life more closely. And then if I went out and made a telescope stronger, I could see more. I figured out that you can actually do that not with the physical things in your life, but with the things that are lurching there, waiting to manifest if you look closely enough. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So the further away that you go so that you could see from a further perspective, gosh, this is hard. I just don't have words. This is just what we were talking about in that book. There are no words to talk about these things. You go out, but then you zoom in at the same time and look literally at the emotions and the feelings that are attached. You can literally start seeing formations of things that help you to identify what's about pending in your life that can come in, or the things you need to keep out. I don't know if that makes any. It's like watching an etheric movie almost.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
I say that all the time because I don't have words to say what I'm saying. Anyway, it was very interesting understanding this morning that I had about that. I'm going to spend some time on it.
Well, you know, that's what we need to look at in medicine and health. We need to look at what are the feelings in the feeling nature of things, not the you know, the matter, the hardcore matter, but the feeling nature of things attached to relationships, attached to our self-image, attached to how we feel about our occupation, and how the feelings will change what manifests in our lives. You know, what, like you say, what is about to come in, what is what is avoidable, what is not avoidable. You know, some of the things, we thought for a while that genetics were unavoidable, but now with the work of some of the cellular biologists, we realize that genetics aren't a death sentence, or, you know, they're not final.
It's funny you bring that up. I was just about to say that was going to be my next statement. Should know that better than you. We're so always on the same page. You know those little switches on the back of computers? They're not there anymore, but they are on the inside, but they used to be on the outside of them. And they're little tiny switches. It looks like a genome, maybe. Little tiny switches, and you take a gym clip or something and flip the one so that your computer could talk to your printer. You remember that years ago?
No, I never saw that.
Oh.
Sorry.
They're these little tiny switches all in a row, and now they're somewhere else in the computer, but they're still there.
Mm.
And I was thinking, if you vibrate something, let's say the wall switches, if you have light switches on your wall, say a whole bunch, you have 15 lights, you have 15 different light switches. You vibrate them hard enough, knock on your wall hard enough, eventually you can make that switch flip because you've given it so much stress that it wears out the switch and it falls. Instead of being flipped up for turned on, it flips down and turns off, or vice versa. You kind of wear it out.
Mm-hmm.
So if emotions are vibratory in nature, and we know that they are, and I know that a physicist hearing this is going to have a problem with these words, but let's just say you hooked it up to one of those things that, one of those machines that shakes your blood. What do you call that? What do you call that thing you spin the blood in?
Centrifuge.
If it didn't spin, but it just shook, one of those things, then I would imagine that eventually the genes or the switches on those genomes are going to break, all because of your emotions. And it's going to flip the opposite way and fall down, you know, flip to the
So on or off, right?
Yeah. So it's only logical that emotions can cause those kinds of epigenetics, those kinds of problems. I think that's the key to where we're going, is epigenetics. You know, Bill Walsh is written about that in his book, what is it, Nutrient Power, I think what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And he did it, you know, 10 years ago before anybody was talking about this stuff, and only now is his book getting some of the credit that it's deserved, about nutrition and emotions causing the MTHFR defect that's in such a big roar right now.
Well, one thing I can tell you about cancer, we found that cancer is organ-based, and that when the energy in the organ goes down sufficiently, and this is kind of ties into David Hawkins, because now you're not talking about the overall vibrational rate, but say the vibrational rate in the breast of a woman. We know that certain biological conflicts such as having someone who's supposed to protect you betray you, or having someone that you're protecting either get in trouble, try to die, or even betray you, either way, that the organ, the energy in the breast can lower, and it depends on whether you're right-handed or left-handed, according to Dr. Hammer's work. So here you have a situation, a trauma that occurs in the life, and then within 6 months to a year, in most cases, then the person will develop breast cancer. And the breast that it develops in is also, you're also able to predict that based on the trauma. So that's a very specific thing that is happening in the life that the person is responding to in a certain way. I mean, you do have a choice in consciousness. You have a choice not to respond that way. Say your husband cheats on you. You could immediately forgive him and then bypass that biological conflict and therefore not get breast cancer. But, you know, depending on where you're vibrating at, you may not be able to forgive him, and you may go into that biological conflict, which Dr. Hammer says you have, like, you lose your appetite, your hands get cold. You know, it's a physiological response with the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems, and that energy in that breast drops down, and you get at the same time a corresponding Hammer lesion that is detectable by CAT scan in the brain on the opposite side. Say you have left breast cancer. In your right brain, in the breast section of the brain, you have a Hammer lesion as long as you have that cancer. So now do you see how, where you're vibrating at, what you do, whether you do, you know, if you're terribly hurt and injured by that betrayal, or if you immediately forgive the person and don't have that injury and hurt, can be the difference between developing breast cancer and not developing breast cancer. So that is a good example of how an emotion can lead to a serious disease.
That makes so much sense to me. You know, years ago, and I think we've talked about this many times, when I first got my ability, my medical intuitive ability, I didn't know, because I have never been sexually violated, thank God. And I didn't know it was so rampant in the world. I just didn't know. I guess I was naive. And when I got my ability, I started finding out that about 7 out of 10 people that I read had been touched inappropriately. Mm-hmm. And the women had breast issues, breast cancer, or either lumps in their breast, or you know, backed up lymph, some kind of breast issue. And the man would have prostate or testicular cancer. And I would hear in my readings that the reason this happened was because they didn't get nurtured in the manner in which they thought they were supposed to be nurtured by the person, their caregiver, the person that they thought, perceived to be the person to take care of them. So they got violated by the person that they thought was supposed to take care of them.
That's a violation of trust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that makes perfect sense to me.
Right. And yet it's not just one thing. It can also be that somebody you're nurturing almost dies, okay? If that's right breast issue in a right-handed woman. So it's left breast that is the inappropriate touching. See, it's very interesting. It's not just one thing. That's why people... I think that's why it can get confusing to people studying it, because more than one thing can lead to, say, left breast cancer or right breast cancer. It's or breast cancer in general. So you have to actually look at a whole bunch of different scenarios and then group them. But I think that is a good example of how an emotion can cause a disease.
You know, there's one more thing. I see that we've got about 8 minutes left, probably.
Mm-hmm.
But first I want to say, before I get off on this, you can get my book on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, or you can go to my website, which is evaher.com. Now, one thing that I've noticed, I know this girl, this young woman, who got raped.
Mm-hmm.
She also got molested several times by one of her older brother's friends. Now, one thing that I, when I talk to this girl and learn about all the things that's happened in her life, I believe there was an event in her childhood that foretold that there were going to be sexual experiences, problems with sexual experiences. And that child, when that girl was a little child, like around 2 or 3, she fell one day on a seesaw and hurt her vagina.
Mm-hmm.
And I've thought about this so many times. I've thought about this, you know, contemplating on it, thinking it through. I really believe that that was an indication to everybody involved that this girl had things that carried on from another life that had to do with sexual inappropriate things.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I still think about it. I think about it a lot. Could that, was that sign a sign to tell us, tell her that there was something that could be done? Or was that, you know, to prevent or change? Or was that sign just an indication that this is what's coming?
I think it depends on if, when you see the sign, if you know that what it portends.
Yeah, obviously they didn't know. But wouldn't
right.
it be interesting to pay attention to things like that that happen beginning early in life, going on through? If you just notice them. If you just notice them.
Mm-hmm.
What you could do
well,
to prevent going
then,
down the road, the rocky road.
Theoretically, if there's a problem area in the body, if you sustain an injury to it, you know, it's like with breast cancer. I've had a number of patients knock into something with their breast in a very particular area of their breast and get an area that's sore, and then within weeks or months develop a cancer in that area.
Really? Why is
that?
Why is
that? We don't know. Maybe it's what you were saying with this person you knew, that when you get an injury to an area, it means that area is lower in energy, less protected.
Yeah, vulnerable, yeah.
More vulnerable. Yeah. So,
certainly something to think about it. That's what we're going to talk
is,
about
yeah.
to dinner tonight.
okay.
That's
well,
the conversation.
Why don't you mention your radio show and your website one more time for the listening audience?
My website is EvaHerr, and that's EvaHerr.com. I have two books, actually. I have one called Agape, The Intent of the Soul, which is a story about my life. It's my story about what happened when I had my epiphany or my enlightenment or whatever you want to call it. It's the story, and it's very woo-woo, and I'm not
mm-hmm.
woo-woo, so it's a hard story for me to swallow, but it's what happened. And then there's my book, Consciousness, Bridging the Gap Between Conventional Science and the New Science of Quantum Mechanics. I just got this wonderful write-up by New Consciousness Review. So you might, if you're interested, you could take a look at New Consciousness Review online and read the editorial review. It was a really good one. I was proud of it. It made me smile.
That's
anyway,
great.
And if you have any questions, you can email me at evaherr@gmail.com. Just be sure and put something in the subject line because that I can distinguish it from all the spam that comes in there.
Right. Well, thanks so much for joining us, Eva. Really appreciate you taking the time. And you're the first person I've interviewed that has actually said how much time we have left. So I know you're another radio show host because you're looking at the clock. That's great. Anyway,
yeah. Thank you, Susan,
thanks a lot, and I'll
me.
See you tonight. Okay.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. This is Dr. Susan Kolb with Temple of Health Radio Show. Next week, I'm interviewing Don Chiro, When the Dragon Wore the Crown. And then the week after, Larry Dossey, One Mind, How Our Individual Mind is Part of a Greater Consciousness and Why It Matters. Thank you very much for joining us, and join us next week.